This evening I wanted to talk about a topic which for Buddhists is maybe very important, maybe for all people, and that is the topic of desire. And there's a lot of confusion in Buddhism about the word desire. It's an English word. And so perhaps I can try to clarify some of the confusion around the word. Sometimes people pick up the idea that desire is bad. You know, Buddhists are not supposed to have any desire, and Buddhism is about letting go of all your desires. And then you wonder how you get to the toilet when you need to pee. Some people actually get frightened when they hear this idea of non-attachment, because they can't imagine a life without any kind of desire at all. And in some ways they're right. It's kind of is somewhat unimaginable, a life without any desire at all. Now the insight part of our meditation practice is to look clearly, see clearly what's going on. And one of the things that's very important to look clearly at is desires itself, to understand desire. And that's true not only because it's a good Buddhist thing to do, but because desire is a really central feature in human life. It's so central that I think human beings should more appropriately be called human desirelings. It's pretty rare that people just be. So this thing about human being is, you know, kind of wishful thinking. What's much more common is that our desires are just, you know, running all the time. And the desires are often shaping the experience we have when we stop and just be. Because there's so much momentum in our desires, in the desiring mind, that you stop and you feel the tension of that sometimes. So desires are very common. And they're both subtle, and they're very gross, they're big. Something as simple as shifting your position in your chair because you want to be a little more comfortable, you can do almost unknowingly. There's a lot of shifting that goes on all the time in our bodies, and we're hardly aware of it. And it represents some little movement of desire. There's a little bigger desires, like, you know, needs to go to the bathroom, or desire to eat if you're hungry, or a variety of things that are basically biological urges, biological needs. And then on the far end of the spectrum of desire, there is things like addiction, tremendous compulsions that seem to grab the person seem to be more in charge of a person than the person is him or herself. Tremendously powerful desires that can get people to do things that later they very much regret, and in their right mind they would never do. They're big desires, small desires, but I would say that if you start paying attention to the movements of desire in your minds and in your being, you will find that it's kind of constant. It's like always little desires going on, wanting something or not wanting something, wanting something to stay, wanting something new to happen, wanting something to go away, wanting something not to come. There's all these wants, all these movements of desire going on. Now it's very important to understand that the word desire in Buddhist English is an inclusive term. And it includes both healthy desires and unhealthy desires. Helpful desires and unhelpful desires. But generally, kind of in colloquial Buddhistese, the word desire gets a little bit of a bum rap. You know, it's kind of, when Buddhists tend to use it, if it's an inclusive term that kind of equally refers to both helpful and unhelpful desires, if it's kind of that inclusive, in Buddhist circles, there's a tendency to kind of like, we lean in the direction that desire is not good. You know, that's kind of, it has a little bit of a bum rap. It's kind of like, we're not exactly equal opportunity employers here. There's a little bit of discrimination in Buddhist circles around this word desire. I'm going to lean in that direction. But it's interesting that maybe there's it is in English also, because the Latin root for the word desire, the word, the de of desire, means Latin for from. And when I look in my dictionary, it says that the root of the word desire the sire part, comes from the Latin root for star. It's a sidus or siderus, something like that. And somehow that becomes desire. And from stars. So, you know, you wish on a star? You hope for something to come from the stars? There can be kind of a... So built into this, in the archaeology of the word desire, is this idea that desire has this wishful thinking component, perhaps. That something is going to, you know, magical thinking, get, you know, having, hoping on something that's maybe unrealistic. But I think it's best to think of the word desire as being an inclusive term, and when it's used, that just simply use the word desire, it's not meant to be either, you know, critical, it could be critical of the word desire or supportive of the word desire, just an inclusive term for a very, very common human functioning. And as I said, now there can be healthy desire and unhealthy desire. But what is also true is that the momentum and movement of desire in the human mind is almost constant, almost going all the time. Whether it's healthy or unhealthy, there's often a kind of a constant stream of it going on. And just to pay attention to see that is going to be quite, you know, surprising to notice that for the first time, how much desire. It takes a subtle mind sometimes to see the subtlety of how it's operating all the time, but it doesn't take much mindfulness to start. And I recommend that to you. Maybe try for a while. Try take an hour or take a sitting of meditation or, and just be very attentive to every movement of desire and name it. There's a desire. There's one. There's a wanting. There's wanting something not to be. Both wanting not to be and wanting are both called desire. And it's so, it's desires in human, the movement of desiring in human minds is kind of like a highway that goes on forever. A highway that never ends. And either good desires, bad desires, still desires, still, you know, this desire highway, it's just not going to end because that's what human minds are just built in to do, is desire. And you know, if you start paying attention enough and you realize you're on this endless highway, if you compare it to driving a car on an endless highway, you know, sometimes you're driving along 101 or Highway 1 in Santa Cruz, Big Sur, it's really beautiful, and sometimes you're on 101 here in the peninsula, and you know, it's sometimes it's really nice and sometimes it's not nice, and but after a while, you're always driving on this car on the freeways. You kind of wish you could take a break. You wish you could get off, you know. It'd be nice to get off and just, you know, stretch your legs or do something a little different or go to a rest stop. But the human mind, kind of, unless we sleep or something, just goes along. And even when it's questionable whether desiring stops when we sleep. The dream world sometimes is, you know, represents a movement of desire as well. My son sometimes talks out loud in his sleep. And he'll say like things like, "Get the ball, get the ball." You know, that's a desire. Get that ball. And so it's an endless highway. And even, you know, if it's just endlessly good desires, it'd be nice to take a break. Enough, you know. It'd be nice to stop and at one of the rest stops and before you have to go further. However, in this highway of desire, we come at some points to a fork. And this is a very important to understand the fork in the world of desire. And the one direction of the fork goes into the direction of craving. And the other goes in the direction of aspiration. And these are not technical Buddhist words exactly, but kind of my attempt to try to distinguish between healthy desire and unhealthy desire. Helpful desire and unhelpful desire. And it's very important to make this distinction. And in that Buddhism is kind of seemingly, you know, kind of superficial view of Buddhism, anti-desire, what it really is, it's Buddhist practice is built to help us put to rest, once and for all, craving, the particular form of desire which is called craving. And craving has a quality of compulsion in it. It's like addictions. Craving has a quality, it's kind of clawing. You kind of, they have clawing connected to craving. There's a tightening, a grasping, a clinging, like the fist tightening up when we grasp. And like when we grasp something, we often grasp more harder than we need to grasp it. So there's, you know, grasping has this extra tense quality that maybe is not necessary in the situation. And craving is said always creates suffering. It creates suffering in and of itself, and the momentum of craving creates suffering down the line also, not just in the moment. So there's one fork is the fork of craving. And the other fork is the fork of aspiration. And whereas craving, that word is associated with clawing, I don't know what the Latin word root for craving is, or the root of it, but the root for aspiration is the word breath. You know, spire, you know, like respire, respiration. And so it comes with something, you know, rather than being imagine something on the stars, something far away, something distant from ourselves. Aspiration begins really close by, close in. It's not a fantasy, but it's actually, it comes out of, in a sense, out of our breath. And aspire literally means to breathe on. And I love that connection to the breath, because when the breath is fluid and relaxed, then the motivations that come out of us are very different than when we're tight and tense. And craving comes with tension. So I like that. The aspiration is you know, a word that can represent the more helpful or positive forms of desire. So we come to this fork, and then the question is, which fork do we take? And the sad thing about the craving fork is sometimes we don't even see that we have a choice. The choice is made for us by the seduction of the craving, and off we go, and we realize minutes, hours, days, months, lifetimes later, uh-oh, I was really, you know, grabbed by this particular form of clinging, and you know, really kind of, you know, just defined my life for me. I was clinging to something. It can be all kinds of stuff. You can cling to security, you can cling to status, you can cling to ego identity, kind of self, senses of self, ideas of self. You can cling to relationships. There's a lot of things you can cling to. And in that clinging, you can make, really can make it centerpiece of your life is defined by that particular form of clinging. And so in a sense, a life can be spent with somewhere in it, somewhere in that life, in the human life, some the suffering that's inherent in that clinging. And some people are so concerned about security or all kinds of things that it's unimaginable not to cling to these things because it's just too frightening or too disorienting not to have these things, so they cling. So one fork is the fork of craving. So some examples of things gone amiss that started off as basically helpful or basic normal human desire is hunger can come with the desire for food. With craving, hunger becomes gluttony. There's all kinds of needs we have, again, needs for food or needs for drink or needs for many things, and those needs can become addictions, needs gone awry. So one of the questions then, by paying attention, is can we remove the desire, the clinging from healthy desires? Can we prevent our healthy desires from being hijacked or taken over by craving? And the sad thing is that sometimes people can have a lot of healthy desires, really good things in principle, but the way that those desires are held, they're held with clinging, held tightly. And that's, you know, so the logic, you know, you look at the desire and see, this is a good desire to have. And so that kind of maybe reinforces our clinging because the desire is actually healthy. And so it seems justified then to cling to it. But, you know, we don't have to take that road. So the other road is aspiration. And aspiration, I'll talk more about, is my word for the healthy desires. So to see the fork, we have to understand both these things really well. And this is one really important aspect of mindfulness practice, is to learn to study our life, to really understand how it's operating, what goes on in our life. Not to kind of read a book and think we understand it, but to read the book in our hearts, to really understand for ourselves how these things work in and of ourselves, what's going on with us. And doesn't, you know, you shouldn't even listen to Dharma talks and think you get it. You should really take the ideas you get in books and talks or whatever, but you have to really see how this applies to yourself. You read your own book in your heart, and how does it work? So reading yourself, you have to understand craving, and you have to understand aspiration in your own heart. And maybe you'll come up with new words, different words in mind then. Maybe these words don't work for you, but this is the words I'm using tonight. So I want to talk a little bit about craving, and then I'll talk about aspiration. And then, you know, I'm not going to say this is the way it is, you know, maybe I will, that my mistake. But when we suggest all kinds of ideas around craving, and then as I talk about them, see if they ring true for you. See if you notice them as something that goes on for you, or maybe take them home with you, these ideas, and use these ideas to help study what goes on in yourself. And if they don't seem to apply to you, then it's fine to forget them, maybe. But one of the very common aspects of craving is that it's very much connected to discursive thinking. A lot of kind of surface thinking. Discursive thinking is when you kind of have a conversation with yourself and kind of lost in stories and ideas and what's going on. And it's kind of like in this other realm, the virtual reality realm of discursive thinking. Whereas aspiration, connected to the breath, is something that feels much more connected to the body in a certain kind of healthy way. It's not so distant and lost in discursive thoughts. So if you have strong desire, for example, strong craving for sexual desire, lust, that can translate into a lot of fantasy. And fantasy can be very compelling, but it's a completely kind of virtual reality world. It can be very pleasant for a while, the wonderful fantasies, but still it doesn't take it away from the fact that it's a virtual reality world. It's this other world, a discursive world that we're kind of caught up in. And so often craving comes along with a lot of discursive thought. And sometimes it comes along with a lot of planning. If we have craving, it means we want something. If we want something, then how do we get it? And so there can be planning. And so the part of discursive thinking is planning. How am I going to get this strategy? Craving also is often connected to our sense of self, or self-identity, or ego. And a lot of craving is egotistical. We crave sometimes because of what it's going to do to my sense of self. If I crave, I could, for example, crave a red sports car. Not because I like red or because I like sports car, I like to go fast, but because if I could pull up to the sidewalk here next to IMC, I'll park right in front if I have the red sports car, then I'd really show all of you my true nature. what a really cool guy I am, and I'm wonderful and I have good taste in cars, and I would just be really hot stuff around IMC, right? You guys, because I'm sure you guys care about such things, right? So the craving is, it has to do with my ego, not because I need to have a car. So a lot of times craving is very often connected to that kind of maybe neurotic sense of self, the self-identity we're caught by. Now, in studying craving, when you look at craving, notice when the kind of desire arises that's kind of clinging or tight or compulsive, there's pressure behind it. One of the interesting things to study is the cost of having craving. What's the cost? It's a very economical thing to study, cost-benefit analysis. What's the cost of craving? And I'll give you some possibilities, something you can study. One is craving can come with tension. Can be exhausting. The bookstore story I like to tell of when I was in my early 20s, I liked to read a lot, and I liked books a lot. And I'd go into bookstores, and I loved going to bookstores, and I noticed after a while that I'd leave the bookstores exhausted. And so I kind of started paying attention, what's going on when I go into bookstores? And I noticed that I didn't have much money, And but I noticed that I would go into bookstores, and basically it was a wanting party. I want that title, I want that book, that book, that book. And each of them, it was so pleasant, it was so alluring, so seductive, these wonderful titles, great ideas, great things I was going to study, great, you know, all kinds of stuff, wanting. And there, you know, there's thousands of titles in the bookstore to want. So I would leave exhausted from all that wanting. So that can happen. I don't know if that happens to any of you. Sometimes I think, I wonder about this internet, you know, or the shopping channel. Once or twice in my life I've glanced at the shopping channel on television, and what's that about? That's kind of, I find that bizarre. They're wanting. It can be tense. It can create exhaustion. That's part of the cost. Craving can also create frustration and grief. Perhaps any desire can, but when there's craving behind it, there's this pressure behind the craving that gives added juice and power to the sense of frustration and grief if it doesn't happen. And that frustration can take more dramatic form, sometimes of great anger, of rage, when desire is frustrated. How could they stand in my way? I deserve this. It should happen. And sometimes the blame is assigned to other people, and tremendous anger towards others because my desire has not been fulfilled. Sometimes the blame or the anger is pointed inwards to myself. Another consequence of craving is a kind of alienation from oneself and others. If we're lost in craving and addictions and the planning and the discursive thoughts and all that, we're kind of in this other world besides the living physical world that we're in. If you're in discursive thought too much, you're not really in a real world. If you're in the world of fantasy, you're not connected. And maybe it's safe to go in fantasy for a short while, but it's possible some people spend hours and hours in fantasy. And perhaps sometimes they're in fantasy while they're in relationship to other people. You know, we call it projection. And as long as we're living in kind of a fantasy world, discursive world, we're kind of removed from what's real. We're alienated. Also, if we're filled with craving, craving usually has something to do about the future. Not always, but often about something we want to get. And if we're concerned about what we're going to get in the future, it's very easy to lose touch with what we have or what's going on right here. And I've known people who spend a lot of the time in the mode of craving, and they really haven't gotten to know themselves very well. And so there's kind of alienation as a result of that. You can also be in some ways be alienated from others also. Not really see them for who they are. You can see them through the filter of how they support or help our craving. And then for another cost that's kind of connected to all this is craving keeps us on the surface of life. If we're constantly involved in craving and wanting, we're not really connected to something deep inside. It's like I want to say craving is often connected to discursive world, to compulsive world, and usually when we're craving, we're not settled on ourselves. And when I study craving or in myself, kind of clinging in myself, I can really feel the difference in my body, how my body shifts and changes when I cling. And since I'm giving a talk right now, I'll use an example from my... I give a lot of talks like this, sitting this way in a meditation posture. And I try to pay attention to my body while I talk. And I've noticed that sometimes if I feel like I'm not getting across my point, like maybe I'm losing my audience or something, then I'll try to talk a little bit in such a way, I have this desire, I want to connect, I want to make my point or be clear or something. And I notice that I can be kind of, up until that point, I can be kind of more or less centered in myself, down my belly and kind of relaxed. And then when the clinging or desire, that kind of desire comes up, I feel myself tensing a little bit up into my belly, up into my stomach, and the energy of my kind of system goes up and kind of forward, and my center of gravity goes forward a little bit. There's a whole physical, energetic movement change that happens to me. But I need to tell you that every time I lean forward, it doesn't mean that I'm clinging. Craving also can create poor judgment. And probably there's been once or twice in your life that you can think of where you were in the grips of some kind of craving. And later you said, gee, what was I thinking? How did that happen? You know, what was that about? Boy. And you're lucky if it's just that simple. My God, what was that about? So it can be like, oh no, what have I done? You know, I just put my kids' college fund all into the California lottery. What have I done? Oh, this is interesting. I read last week. I don't know how they did this analysis exactly, but you know, there's a lot of research now in happiness, and that's really popular. Great, so that's really popular research. And so they measure people's happiness, and so they went and measured, I guess, the happiness of people who won the lottery a year after they won the lottery, and they discovered their happiness quotient, or something, you know, as you know, the average. The amount of happiness they had was the same as someone a year after they'd become quadriplegic. So I'm not quite sure what to make of that, you know, because it's kind of, you know, I don't know what that means about quadriplegics. I don't want to jump to conclusions. But that's quite a correlation. So, you know, I don't know how many of you buy lottery tickets. And you know, what's the craving? What's the wishful thinking? What's the dreaming on a star? And then the danger is, if you get it, you could be happy for a little while. But you know, I'm sure you've all read the articles about people whose lives just went downhill when they won some big jackpot. So poor judgment can happen when we're in the grips of craving and clinging. That's one of the costs. And then the last one, the last thing I'll mention, the cost of craving, is one that maybe is kind of unpopular to mention here in the West. We don't talk about it much. But you find the Buddha talked about this sometimes. And so you could do what you want. But the when a person's in the grip of a lot of craving, they become unpleasant. Unpleasant. Or ugly or something. So then another thing to study around craving is what fuels craving. What motivates craving? What's going to get it going? What triggers it? And I mentioned some of these already. One can be self-image, the way we want to represent ourselves to the world or to ourselves. And it's so important, the sense of self, the self-idea, that people will do almost anything. You know, so there's a lot of craving in order to build that up, and make themselves something. Sometimes craving is fueled by pleasure, sensual pleasure, for example, comfort, the desire for pleasure. So feeling comfortable, feeling the delight of that. And sometimes fantasies are driven by the pleasure of the fantasy rather than the object of the fantasy. Just the fantasy itself is pleasant. It's interesting to go on retreat, where meditation retreats, I just came back from one today. And something which can seem relatively innocent in daily life, you know, you can go off on a fantasy for 5-10 minutes or something and, you know, wake up and continue doing what you're doing or something. But on retreat sometimes, certain tendencies don't get interrupted so easily. And so some people, you know, get off into fantasy, and it can be a very pleasant fantasy and they really enjoy it for a while. But after 30 minutes or an hour or 2 hours of it, you start feeling, even though it's pleasant in a certain kind of way, it's exhausting. It really puts a tremendous strain and toll on the mind to be kind of churning and churning and churning. And it's very, very interesting about retreats to see that quality that we don't see necessarily, that how the energetic toll it takes on us when it just, you know, we do it for a few minutes. Sometimes craving is fueled by the desire for security. Sometimes it's fueled by the desire to be distracted. The present moment sometimes is not so interesting or so pleasant or so, you know, people have all kinds of sometimes problems with the present moment. And so, you know, maybe there's strong emotions or strong feelings or something, so they'd like to check out. And so craving is one of the ways to kind of try to get things to be different rather than being present for what is. Sometimes craving is fueled by a sense of emptiness or voidness, or you know, some kind of way in which we feel kind of empty or whole in ourselves. And in this regard, I kind of think it's cute that the word wanting has a dual meaning. It means both desire, to want, but it also has this meaning in English of the soup is wanting salt. It kind of, you know, it's lacking, what it means. So sometimes a sense of lack that can give birth to, it's kind of uncomfortable to lack, and so we want to fill that lack with something, with food or, you know, shopping or something. And the last thing about the fuel for craving, which is a very interesting one in Buddhist psychology. Buddhist psychology teaches that one of the fuels and triggers for craving is craving. It's kind of like a self-perpetuating system. Once you get into the system of craving, it's kind of uncomfortable, it kind of has self-perpetuating quality to it, you're uncomfortable in some way, and so you want more. And so the image of this is a monkey. Monkey mind, where a monkey, the image is that of a monkey who wants to get fruit from a tree. So it grabs one fruit, then it sees another one, so it grabs the next fruit. So now it has two fruits and one fruit in each hand. Then it sees a third fruit, so it drops the first one and grabs the next one. And then it sees a fourth fruit, so it drops and, you know, it's always grabbing and grabbing and grabbing, can never get enough. So when we have a monkey mind, we have a mind that's just kind of filled with wanting, wanting, wanting. I see it in my young kids sometimes. You know, just it's just amazing. You know, just wanting, wanting, wanting. So there's some way in which craving is a fuel for craving. Then the other question to ask or to explore is, how do you work with craving? How do you deal with it when it comes up? It's very important to have some tools, some ability to practice with it. And I'd like to mention one of the first, a very important tool in our practice, in Vipassana practice, and that is to note it, to label it when it comes up. Say to yourself, oh, craving, clinging. Just say it. And you can even be more specific if it's easy. You can say, oh, craving chocolate. You can say, oh. And it has a number of functions, the noting. One is the noting is a way to help us to really acknowledge what we're seeing. It's possible to be kind of mindful of something, but not really have acknowledged it. And mindfulness is a practice of really acknowledging what's here, really being present for it to the degree that you're really almost acknowledging it. And in that acknowledgement, it actually helps you to be free. So we note it, we name it. The other thing is that if you note on a regular basis, you might start noticing the patterns. You might notice, for example, how often you are craving. How often you have desire. You might have no idea until you actually started kind of noting. Oh, there's another one, another one, another one. Boy, I had no idea they were going on all the time. And so noting might help you with that. And the other thing is that you might notice certain patterns. You notice that it seems like every third desire I have is for chocolate. I had no idea. I thought I was desiring something else, but when I look at the evidence, it's really, that's the issue. And so by noting, sometimes, you know, you can actually notice patterns you wouldn't notice any other way. And it's helpful to do that. So noting can be a very helpful practice. Another way to work with desire is to let it go. If it's so costly, maybe it's helpful to just let it go. And sometimes it's possible. Okay, I don't need that one. But sometimes it's not so easy just to let go. Probably some of you know, letting go sometimes is very hard. Sometimes when it's hard to let go, a useful strategy is to ignore it. You can't let go of it, but you just kind of continue your life ignoring it. You don't act on it. Kind of pretend it's not there. Just kind of do what you have to do. Sometimes that's wise, because sometimes certain kinds of craving can just atrophy. And part of the reason why craving is strong is it becomes a habit. If we keep acting on craving and living with craving and engaging in it, it actually feeds it as a habit. But if we just ignore it and don't feed it with our life energy, then that craving sometimes can just kind of atrophy or not be an issue. Sometimes that's useful, to ignore it. Wise ignoring. Another thing to do in our practice, in mindfulness practice, is to feel it really well. don't push it away, don't ignore it, but really kind of drop into your body and be with a felt sense of what it feels like to desire. Like when I lean forward, there's a felt sense of tightening and lifting that goes on and moving forward. So, you know, what does it feel like? What does it feel like in the mind? What does it feel like in the heart? What does it feel like in the body? What's the felt sense? And then to feel it. And feel it with care. Feel it as if you have permission, it has permission to be there. Don't feel it with aversion or, you know, just lots of space. You want to create space for the experience you're going to feel. And then feel what it's like. What this means is that when you have desire, you want to turn your attention 180 degrees away from the object of desire, of clinging or craving, to what it feels like to be desiring. So you're craving chocolate. So you don't have to stop craving the chocolate. You have to turn your attention away from the chocolate to what it feels like to be craving the chocolate. And then feel it really well. There's a lot of benefits to feel spaciously, openly, what's going on here. Not to be quick to push it away and all that. One of the advantages is that we can understand it in a new way. Another is that these emotions and feelings and motivations that come with craving have their own process and own unfolding they need to do if we get out of the way. And I have a tremendous trust in that inner movement of unfolding of, you know, self-liberating quality of these things if we don't act on it and just feel it. Also, if we feel really well, you might find out that the craving is really the cover, the storefront for something else. And it might be, for example, that really what's going on is a sense of lack or a sense of loneliness. And so if you just kind of let go of the craving too easily, you might not ever actually have a chance to see the loneliness. But if you feel the craving really carefully, respectfully, then you might begin to tease apart some of the deeper issues that are going on that might be the reason for why you're craving in the first place. So to feel, to really feel, and it takes time, it takes generosity of spirit to just kind of, okay, there's my craving, and this is my chance to get to know it and really feel it and give it, you know, it's not pleasant, I wish it wasn't there, but it's here, so I'm going to just give it all the time it needs so I can really feel it. There's a particular form of this kind of feeling, craving, which I think is a really great practice. I call it riding out a desire. And that is, you have to wait. You have to kind of plan to do that. You kind of plan you're going to do this. Anticipate you're going to do this. And keep an eye out for a really good craving. When you, you know, something has really got you. You know, and if you, this is a particular thing that's sometimes recommended for people with addiction issues. So when you really have a strong addiction, it's really grip you, your addiction. sit down. It can be in a chair. It doesn't have to be meditation. Just sit down and feel that that drivenness, that addiction, that quality. And really feel it well. But be committed not to give into it. You're going to ride it out like the rodeo. You might have to break out in the sweat. It might be really hard going. But you're going to stay in that chair. You're not going to leave. You're not going to go to the store and get cigarettes or whatever. You're there committed. You're going to ride it out. And, for some people, it can be extremely difficult. And some people have a whole firm of lawyers in their mind that are ready to argue the case of why it's reasonable and appropriate and necessary to have this addiction fulfilled at this very moment. And I've known people, you know, amazing, you know, wonderful legalistic minds that will kind of try to find a way around the precepts. You know, well, you know, the Buddha probably meant when he said, you know, don't lie, you know, there's that word, you know, lie has an E in it, and the E, this little E has a little hole in it, and probably, you know, I could just, he probably a little exception for that kind, you know, or with sex, you know, probably, you know, Buddha, he lived a long time ago, and it was kind of puritanical society probably, and after all this is California, and what does Buddha know about sex, and you know, just, it's probably okay here with that person's wife, And so, you know, the lawyers come in. And you're kind of lucky if you have lawyers. It means that you haven't acted on it yet. Some people just, it's an urge. And so every urge is to be believed. And so you don't think about it. You just act, I'm a doer, so. You find out afterwards. And then the lawyers come into play afterwards to justify. Not, give reasons afterwards. So, so writing out a desire, so you might feel, and sometimes with addiction it gets really strong, gets tremendously compelling, and you just get committed to sit still, don't act on it, sit in your chair, don't get up, it's like a wild bronco, and sooner or later, I guarantee it, you'll be on the backside of that wave, this big wave, you feel like you're caught in the wave, it's really strong, and sooner or later it'll pass, and you'll find yourself on the other side, and things will get calm again. And for people with addiction issues, that practice of writing out a desire is very encouraging. It's very empowering. Realize that you have an ability to not give in to an addiction. It's possible to go to the other end. When sometimes in the heat of the addiction, it seems like you're going to die if you don't get it. And so to see that you can do that is, great. So you can note it, you can let go, you can ignore it, you can feel it, you can write it out. And the last thing you can do is you can study it. So all these things are forms of study, but to really study it, like you're going to get, if craving is a big issue for your life, pretend you're going to get a PhD in craving. And you're really going to get to know it well. You're going to explore it, and you're not going to get a good, you're not going to get past your dissertation unless you really have studied this phenomena carefully. So really study it well. And part of the reason for that is that it's a lot easier to become free of something if you know it really well. If you haven't got to know it well, it's sometimes harder to be liberated from it. And one of the interesting things to study around desire, craving, is if there's craving, there can often be thoughts connected to it. Planning, desires, thinking thoughts around it. And the thoughts by themselves are kind of just words, perhaps. So you kind of feel, you see the kind of thoughtsness of the desire. But separate from the words, what's going on with craving that's separate from the words and the thoughts? What energetically in your body that's, because you can, all of you, maybe it's dangerous to suggest this, but I can suggest that you, all of you, create a thought right now. I'll say it, and then in your mind, silently, you can repeat after it, me, right? Okay? So if unless you protest, this is too much, but it's innocent. You can decide after you hear what I'm going to say. But why don't you just say this to yourself silently after I say it? I would like chocolate. Maybe that's not a good one. I would like a rye cracker. Maybe that's more neutral, right? I would like a rye cracker. So you can say those words. The words go through your mind, right? And then for some of you, if you say, I want chocolate, and it's not just words, right? And it's like, you can feel the flavor of it in the mouth, and just like, something extra happens with craving besides the words. What's that extra thing? Energetically, physically, emotionally. What is that extra thing that makes a thought into a craving? And that's fascinating, to kind of be there at the edge. What is that? Another thing to study around craving is our beliefs. Not so the world of thoughts, in a sense, but what are the beliefs around it? I need this. Unless I get this, something else is not going to happen. And then, as I keep saying now, you can also study the effect of craving on the body, mind, and speech. Well, it's 9:00, and I only got through half of it. And the craving part. And, I shouldn't have left the good news for the end. There is the other side of craving, of desire. So remember, there's a fork in the highway. And the other fork is the fork of aspiration. And aspiration is I take aspiration, that form of desire that I call aspiration, to be a really beautiful quality of the human heart, of human beings. Aspiration is some of the most beautiful things that exist in human beings, to aspire to. There's beautiful intentions and motivations that can arise inside of us. There are some really beautiful aspirations that people live by. And in fact, it's possible to have a person's your life be motivated and oriented around aspiration and not around craving. And the quality of the life changes dramatically depending if it's one or the other. So I'm sorry I didn't do the aspiration part. But maybe, should we do it next week?
Yeah.
And the problem is that the talk was a whole. And I don't know how to, I can't just start about aspiration next week, people who didn't hear this first part. But I'll figure it out over the week. Maybe I'll have to do a little quick summary about craving. And then we can launch into aspiration. That's my aspiration. Thank you.